Hello, and welcome to another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. On the program this week,
how does the health of low-income Arkansans compare to other states 2 years after the passage of Medicaid expansion?
It's back to school time. An Arkansas lawmaker delivers a report on the education system in the U.S. and other countries. The state GOP removes mention of pre-K from its party platform. And a special ed task force prepares an upcoming report after more than a year of work.
Inaccuracy in the Secretary of State's office list of flagged felons on the voter rolls provokes a public records dispute with the state Democratic Party.
After decades of construction, a final segment of U.S. 67 between North Little Rock and Walnut Ridge opens for four-lane travel. We'll be joined by Jonathan Reeves of Jonesboro Station KASU, who covered the dedication.
And Arkansas is well represented at the Summer Olympics in Rio. We'll talk about which athletes to watch for. All that's just ahead. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Michael Hepling.
Well, Sarah, this week we learned of a report, sort of a national study, done by some doctors looking at the actual health outcomes from states who've expanded Medicaid as a result of the Affordable Care Act. We often talk about Medicaid expansion in terms of dollar numbers, in terms of economic impact or savings to the state. But this study specifically looked at the actual health of people. Could you give us more?
Yeah, so I spoke with the Harvard doctor who has been doing this research for several years about states that have expanded Medicaid, specifically Arkansas, Kentucky, and then Texas, which didn't, and how the health of low-income people has fared. And what they found is that Arkansas and Kentucky have seen dramatic improvements in healthcare access and the well-being of populations compared to Texas. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And so I spoke with Dr. Benjamin Summers about what he found.
In the two states that expanded coverage, Arkansas and Kentucky, there were dramatic changes for most of the outcomes we studied in terms of improvement in people's ability to afford the care they need, people's ability to have a primary care provider, and shifting towards outpatient care and preventive care, like having a checkup in the past year and more office visits with less reliance on the emergency department. And overall, we found that people reported the quality of their care was better, and the share of people who said their health was excellent also improved in Arkansas and Kentucky compared to Texas, which didn't expand coverage.
Anything else that the report mentioned?
Well, one thing he talked about was that one of the arguments against Medicaid expansion is that Medicaid, because it's run by the government, is ineffective. And he said, not just does this prove to him that states that expanded Medicaid have healthier populations, but that Medicaid works, and that this is a model for other states looking particularly at Arkansas, because Arkansas, with the private option, allows people to purchase private insurance. So for states that are having debates about moving away from the private sector, it's a compromise. Kentucky has public insurance, and there's little difference between the two in terms of outcomes. So I guess it proves that they're both an option, in stark contrast to the no Medicaid expansion option.
All right. Interesting. So we'll touch on a few different small education stories. First off, I just want to mention at the beginning of the week, actually over the last weekend, the state GOP delegates met in Rogers to shape their party platform. And one big story that came out of it was the removal of a paragraph mentioning pre-kindergarten education, suggesting that all children in the state have a right to pre-kindergarten education. This made some headlines. Our colleague Jacob Kaufman talked with a couple of state legislators, members of the GOP, chairman of the Legislative Committee on Education. And basically what their reasoning boils down to, they're afraid that by mentioning pre-kindergarten as a right, they would give the suggestion that it should be mandatory. I'm not exactly sure why this is an issue, but certainly an interesting development, as we have seen in the past couple of legislative sessions, a little bit of a struggle between Democrats and Republicans over funding pre-kindergarten education. It's been notably flat for the last few years. Certainly worth noting ahead of the next general session of the legislature in 2017.
And interestingly, a prominent Democrat from Arkansas State Senator Joyce Elliott of Little Rock was in Chicago this week presenting at the National Council of State Legislators an education report comparing the United States to other countries that have seen higher success rates in their educational systems and found that the U.S. is lagging behind 30 other countries in educational achievement. They say we're falling behind our competitors in that area. And one of the key findings that Elliott presented was pre-K as being worldwide one of the elements of a successful education system. Others were just generally planning that's not predicated on sort of political party and dramatic shifts between strategies based on testing results. So what she said is that tests in other countries are used to inform policies in a slow and deliberate way, rather than kind of being a prompt to make a dramatic change, you know, in terms of like taking over a system in distress, for example.
Which is the case here in Little Rock, which she's opposed to already, obviously.
And then the other big element was supporting teachers, investing in teachers' career paths as a incremental ladder where teachers can see their trajectory of stepping up as they gain experience. So those were the big components that she presented, and she's been a part of this national group doing education work for a while. So anyway, we'll see if that comes up in conflict with the Republican Party's position, but I guess they're separating in camps and getting farther away on the pre-K issue, which in neighboring states, actually, I think Republicans like in Oklahoma have gotten behind it, and they've put funding into pre-K and some other southern Republican states. So
yeah, Oklahoma is definitely a deeply Republican state. And I remember like Jacob had talked to Bruce Cozart, is the chairman of the House Education Committee, and he basically reaffirmed his support for pre-K. We shouldn't necessarily give this kind of blanket characterization of all Republicans in the state, but he reiterated his support for pre-K education, said it was an important component of the larger education system and, you know, the future of the state and whatever. But there's just this issue of giving it the image of being like a mandatory thing here in the state.
Well, speaking of funding needs, you covered a task force meeting on special ed in the state and found that they're asking for some more money too. What are they saying there?
Yeah, so it's called the Legislative Task Force on Best Practices for Special Education. They met for the final time this week. They've been meeting for over a year. It was the result of a law passed in the 2015 session by the late Representative Sheila Lampkin, who died in July just recently. She's a former educator, former special needs teacher, and she wanted to start up this task force to kind of explore the different ways the state can improve the services to the state's special needs kids, kids with disabilities in the schools. So it's a task force of about a couple dozen people, legislators, educators, some advocates from nonprofits, and parents also were involved. I talked with State Senator Uvalde Lindsay, a Democrat from Fayetteville. He's been the chair of the task force, and they're about to issue a report coming up on September 1st. It's the culmination of all their meetings for over a year. And the report will call for several things. Chief among them, he emphasized that based on the meetings, that people who are involved in special education in the state just need to do the very simple thing of working together.
We say tear down the silos that isolate each one of us, each one of our particular divisions or organizations or programs, and help us just sort of blend all the best of what we do together into a cohesive delivery of service.
He means basically that the nonprofits and the Department of Education need to start working together better and developing policies and plans to assist special needs kids. There's also this issue of funding in the state for services to kids who have these quote-unquote catastrophic disabilities. These are disabilities that are expensive to deal with on the public level. They require a lot of resources, a lot of people to help out these kids. His point was that this area has had flat funding for the last 10 years, ever since the state came up with a new funding formula for education in response to this landmark Lakeview State Supreme Court decision, which required the legislature to really revamp the whole way the state education system is funded to be more equitable. And here he is talking about this catastrophic fund for kids with severe disabilities.
We have $30 million in documented needs, but only $11 million of funding. Funding's been flat since Lakeview, 10 years now, and the funding is still at $11 million, just like it was in Lakeview. But the needs have tripled. The number of kids receiving catastrophic service 5 years ago was less than 500. Now it's pushing 1,400, almost three times the number of kids, same amount of money. What does that mean? It means we're underfunding the needs of those kids that have a catastrophic issue of disability.
And in addition to this catastrophic fund, the group will also likely ask for more than a $100 million increase in funding over several years to increase the number of special ed teachers in the classroom and teacher's aides. Right now, the state funds 2.9 special ed teachers for every 500 students, and this group wants to increase that ratio to 3.3 special ed teachers for every 500 students. But basically, this task force will submit a report to the governor, to the different legislative leaders, House Education Committee, Senate Education Committee. On September 1st, Lindsay said he wasn't sure whether or not any actual legislation will come up in the next general session about this, but he said, you know, it's a possibility. This week saw also the further development of this story that's been in the headlines for last 2 or 3 weeks regarding this list of flagged felons that was given by the Secretary of State's office to different county clerks around Arkansas back in June. And as county clerks had gone through this list of registered voters who needed to be taken off the voter rolls because they were felons, they began to find that many of them actually had all their voting rights restored, and some of them were not even felons and had, you know, no reason to be on this list. And so this has been kind of an ongoing issue. Different county clerks have been dealing with this in their own way. But what happened this week is the state Democratic Party had asked for records pertaining to this list of flagged registered voters who are listed as felons. Sarah, could you kind of take us through what this dispute was? The Democratic Party made a records request. It wasn't initially honored by the Secretary of State, but later in the week it was.
Right. And what that came down to was the Secretary of State's office, according to the Democratic Party's legal counsel, I spoke to Christopher Burks, he said that his understanding was the Secretary of State's office stalled and then got an opinion from the Attorney General as to what they should do. And the Attorney General said, you have to release this by law. And then they agreed to. The reason I don't know from the Secretary of State's office is because they wouldn't respond for comment. And I know the Democrat Gazette said the same, that they weren't speaking to them. So I spoke with Chris Burks, and he said one of the reasons they wanted to get the emails and other documents leading up to the Secretary of State's request from the Crime Information Office for this felon roll was to try to assess what their motive was in doing that, given that what he said is, you know, the Democratic Party believes that the voter rolls were updated and the ones that they requested were dating back to the 70s, which included the names of felons who, like you said, up, you know, until at this point have, many of them have their voting rights restored, and some of them are not even felons. They were mistakenly on this list. And so the Secretary of State's office sent this updated list with these outdated, potentially, names to the county clerks with the message or the disclaimer, there might be some errors here. And so now the county clerks are trying to assess, which of these people, largely African-American men, up to close to 8,000, which of them have the right to vote, actually. So anyway, the Democratic Party is suspicious of what was behind this. The Secretary of State's office has said it was a mistake. And so here's Chris Burks on why they want the documents. They got them today, Friday. So we don't know what is in them yet, but here he is.
And he's with the Democratic Party.
He's their attorney.
Right. So Mark Martin got information from the Crime Information Office, the ACIC, and also the Department of Corrections. And he has a duty to maintain and administer those lists and then send the proper lists out to all 75 county clerks. What Mark Martin did was send a list out to county clerks that was not properly maintained and administered, that was full of errors. And that may have been 4,000 errors, it may have been 7,000 errors, it may have been more. We don't know because he hasn't given us those documents yet.
So you're trying to prove that the office did email him the updated information and he just didn't apply it?
Well, not only that he received information from ACIC, but how he edited the voter file in his office and how he then communicated that information out to the county clerks. So, for example, he could have sorted that information by year. He could have said, okay, we're going to send the county clerks a list of everybody that we think has a felony in the last 10 years. And as you know, and as your listeners know, that information was full of errors that Mark Martin had a duty to properly administer. So we want to know what was going on, what was said to the county clerks, what was said to, you know, within the office, because Mark Martin's public position to date has been it's on the county clerks to fix any error. And we want to know, you know, when was Mark Martin aware of any error? What did he do to fix it? And what did he not do to fix it? So we think the public has a right to know all that.
And one thing Burks emphasized to me is their legal stance, his legal stance is that it doesn't matter what the intent of this action was. Ultimately, it matters what the result is for legal purposes. So it sounds like they might not take the Secretary of State to court because they got the documents, but the result is possibly this disenfranchisement.
All right, we're going to magically transport ourselves to a studio containing Michael Hiblin and Jonathan Reeves of Jonesboro Station KASU to talk about some highway news.
Well, this week, two projects that have been decades in the making were dedicated in Northeast Arkansas. And anyone who has ever traveled between the Little Rock area and Jonesboro has been well aware that there have long been stretches where you have to go down to two lanes, and it breaks up the trip somewhat. But with the two projects dedicated this week, you can now go all the way to Jonesboro by four-lane highways, interstate quality. Jonathan Reeves with Jonesboro Station KASU joins me now. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Michael.
So you were at the dedication ceremony Thursday. Was there a lot of excitement from officials there?
Yeah, there was, and I'll tell you, we had two dedications that took place on Thursday. The first one happened in Walnut Ridge, and really this highway that you're talking about, 167, now gives four-lane access all the way from Little Rock to Walnut Ridge. Before this happened, of course, you would have to get off at Jonesboro and take the 226 highway, which was a four-lane and turned into a two-lane. But essentially what this will do is a lot of people were excited, not only because of the potential economic development that this could bring, but also making it a lot easier for people in this part of the state and now in Walnut Ridge as well to be able to travel a four-lane road all the way to Little Rock, to central Arkansas. Makes it very makes it huge for a couple of reasons. One, because this is another four-lane road that has opened up that has an official designation. And what I mean by that is that we had Highway 63 earlier in the year turn into Interstate 555. Well, now with the way that the 167 is now going all the way to Walnut Ridge, Senator John Bozeman's office has been working on making that highway the Interstate 555. 57 designation. It'll be a future I-57 designation, which will eventually allow that interstate to go from Little Rock to where it joins up at Sykeston and eventually up to Chicago. So exciting news yesterday. A lot of people very excited about what they, what this will mean by way of the economic development aspect of it, and also what eventually, several years down the road, what it'll mean as this road goes all the way up to Missouri. That is in the plans.
Yeah. Why don't we hear a cut here? This is Director Scott Bennett of the State Highway and Transportation Department talking about how significant this announcement was.
We have opened now two stretches of highway in northeast Arkansas today, a $160 million project that extended Highway 67 from Newport up to Walnut Ridge, and now this almost $85 million project for Highway 226 to connect Jonesboro to Highway 67. It really connects northeast Arkansas to the rest of the state with a four-lane divided highway, so the possibilities are endless, really. We talk about highway improvements for safety and mobility a lot of times, but these are really two improvements that are going to have a significant impact for economic development for northeast Arkansas also.
And I know from my own experiences, 25 years ago, I was a student at ASU, and I was coming from North Little Rock, and I think anyone who's been in that situation can really appreciate the significance of this.
You know, when you travel on that road, and I've traveled that road many times, my wife actually more than I have, but you just get used to going off when you're coming from Little Rock to Jonesboro, and you know that interstate's going to end or that highway is going to end right there at Jonesboro. It goes into a single lane, if you will. Now knowing that it's going to be four lane, and it is four lane now, all the way to Walnut Ridge and eventually up to Missouri, that is huge. And there was a lot of excitement. Talked to Walnut Ridge Mayor Charles Snapp, and actually talked to him this morning for a little bit. Don't have that cut with me, but what he was really excited about is just really the possibilities are endless now, as to you'll probably see, you know, convenience stores on that area, on that stretch, that hasn't been open before, and of course the economic development, what that's going to mean to the area there. And what he was really excited about is now it makes it a lot easier to be able to get people from Central Arkansas into Walnut Ridge for events like Beatles at the Ridge that they have every year. Of course, the Rock and Roll Highway. There's a lot of music tourism that is in this area. So just very, very excited for what the future is going to bring, and how much easier now it's going to be for people to be able to come into Walnut Ridge, Jonesboro, northeast Arkansas.
Yeah, ease of travel really is important. And you mentioned that now they're studying what to do with the rest of U.S. 67. And you and I drove up U.S. 67 going to the Public Radio News Directors Conference back in June. And it's kind of dramatic once you, after being on two-lane highways in the extreme northern parts of Arkansas, you cross into Missouri, and there it's just a beautiful, scenic, divided four-lane highway. There's such a dramatic change between Arkansas and Missouri. And now Scott Bennett says they're working or looking at what to do with that.
We are in the planning stages for the extension of Highway 67 up to Missouri, looking at several different alternatives, and we actually have a little bit of money set aside in our next program to begin the environmental phase, which will have a lot more detail on the location studies and hopefully come up with a preferred alignment. Then it's just a matter of coming up with $300 to $500 million total to complete it.
And I imagine, Jonathan, people up in towns like Corning and Pocahontas are really eager to see something happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives them a lot of hope to be able to know it. And this was something, when we posted this on our Facebook page, that's what a couple of our listeners were saying, that you know, it would be great when they were able to get 67 up through those communities that you're talking about, you know, Corning, Pocahontas, and that, to be able to make it four lane. It's going to take some time, and as you said, with the price tag, it might have been a little confusing and hard to hear at that last bit, but that's not three; it's 300. $100 to $500 million. When I asked him about how much money that they had, he said, I'm not quite sure. He said there was a little bit of money there, but they're really excited about this. But now comes the environmental studies and the design phase, and there have already been people who have been talking about, well, maybe it should follow this particular route, or maybe it should follow another particular route. So that's going to be in the design, engineering, and other phases. It'll take several more years before we see that happen, but that is definitely very exciting that that we're going to see that, and that is in the future, but not in the immediate future, obviously.
Right. It is such a slow process, and you have to acquire land and then the construction process. So, yeah, it's easily why these things, after decades of work, when they are completed, are a big deal for a lot of people.
Well, and when you think about how long it took for Highway 67 to go from where it is, where it starts in Little Rock, to where it is now currently, you're talking about a span of 40 to 50 years to be able to build as much as it did. Going back to Highway 63, which is now Interstate 555, for reference, that's from Jonesboro all the way down to around the Turrell area. It's about a 40, 45-mile stretch, but that took well over 40 years to be able to develop, and 20 of those years to make it interstate quality. So, yeah, it is going to be quite some time, but I think the excitement is that, yes, there are plans there to be able to extend it. And then once we can go into Missouri, as you well stated earlier when we went to that public radio conference, to be able to connect that from a two-lane to a four-lane and just have an uninterrupted flow of traffic, that'll definitely make it a lot nicer.
All right. Well, that's Jonathan Reeves with our partner station KASU in Jonesboro. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it. Glad to come back anytime.
All right, Chris, so it's my last week of Morning Edition, my last day. Oh. But I have to say, I have been staying up late watching the Olympics, sitting through the gymnastics and the swimming. But there are some other sports that are going on where there are Arkansans there playing in Rio.
Right, yeah.
I know you looked into that. So who did you hear about?
As we record this, it's Friday morning. But tonight, on Friday night, track and field is starting, the first track and field competitions, where several Arkansans are competing. Actually, let's make sure we don't get confused here. There are actually six native Arkansans competing in the Olympics, some of them in track and field. There are two sisters, Isabella Isaacson and Margot Isaacson, competing in the modern pentathlon, which is kind of a crazy sport that involves like shooting and swimming and horseback riding. But there are also several competitors, athletes from the University of Arkansas. In fact, 18, which is more than many countries have competing. Although not all of those competitors are native Arkansans, not all of them are going to be representing the U.S. and their current and former University of Arkansas athletes. And a majority of them are in track and field. I talked with both the men's and women's coaches at the University of Arkansas track and field, just kind of talking about, you know, the athletes, how confident they feel they're going to do. This is Lance Harder. He's the UA women's track and field coach. He's been checking in with his assistant coaches. He has two assistant coaches who are helping out the U of A athletes, the Razorback athletes who are in Rio right now. And here's kind of what they're talking about.
Basically, the conversation is, you know, are they in good spirits? Are they sleeping well? Are they eating okay? Because obviously there's lots of changes that occur when you live in the Olympic Village. You know, are they enjoying their time? Because again, this is a very, very special time. And you just want to make sure the basics of life are being well attended to, and that they're ready physically and psychologically to give a good performance.
Some athletes to look out for on the women's side. Veronica Campbell-Brown is competing for Jamaica, but she's a former Razorback. She's won Olympic medals already. She's going to be competing in the 200 meters and the relay as well. Sandy Morris and Lexi Weeks are two women's pole vaulters who are Razorbacks as well. Lexi Weeks is an Arkansas native. She's from Cabot. That competition is next Friday. Let's see. On the men's side, we've got Jerrion Lawson, who's competing in the men's long jump. And he actually was in the NCAA championships earlier this year, and he won the men's long jump, the 100 meters, the 200 meters, and he's the only person to do that since Jesse Owens did in 1936. So quite an accomplishment there, certainly one to look for. He's from Texarkana, the Texas side of Texarkana. He's also going to be competing in the long jump with Jeff Henderson, who's not from the U of A, but he did graduate from Sylvan Hills High School in Sherwood, Arkansas. He's from McCalmont, which is a community just between North Little Rock and Sherwood. Obviously, those are two athletes you want to look out for if you're watching track and field, the men's long jump, Jerrion Lawson and Jeff Henderson. So, and that competition, again, begins tonight as we record this, Friday night, with a final on Saturday, August 13th. I also talked with the head coach of the men's side at the U of A, Chris Bucknum. Here he is. I don't know. I asked him how confident he feels in his athletes who are there in Rio.
Yeah, it's hard to predict, you know, especially on this stage with the brightest light of their career on them. But, you know, we feel good about, you know, where they're at. You know, Clive Poulin, our triple jumper from Jamaica, is an NCAA champion for us this year. He's an SEC champion twice. You know, he's back in the rankings a little bit, but the goal for him would be to make the, you know, the finals, which is probably the final nine jumpers. If there's 40 jumpers down there, you want to make the finals, and that would be his goal, is to get into contention where he can medal. And then you've got Omar McLeod, who is the reigning world indoor champion in the 60-meter hurdles. It's 110 meters outdoors, but he's the reigning world champion indoors. He's only 22 years old, and he's got the fastest time in the world this year. So, you know, he is dealing with a lot of that kind of pressure because he's one of the favorites for the gold medal. And then you have Jerrion Lawson, who is coming off of an epic NCAA championship where he duplicated only what Jesse Owens has done, and that's win three events. And quite interestingly, not only that, but his long jump of 28 feet, 1.5 inches, that is the longest legal jump in the world in the last 10 years.
So has anyone won anything yet?
No one has won anything yet. Like I said, the track and field competitions where a majority of these Razorbacks are going to be, you know, at the Maracana Stadium in Rio, 78,000-seat stadium. Those competitions begin tonight, so we'll see. But I would say, you know, Jerrion Lawson, Jeff Henderson, they're certainly favorites in the long jump, as are Clive Poulin and Omar McLeod, although those two guys are competing for Jamaica. They are University of Arkansas athletes. I will say, you know, there have been some Olympians here that have competed in past Olympics. For instance, Michael Tinsley, he's not with the University of Arkansas, but he's from Little Rock. He placed silver in the 2012 Olympics in London for the men's 400 meter hurdles. He competes in that same event on Monday. So he could have a repeat, or maybe he'll, you know, get a different medal.
Great. Well, I look forward to hearing how they did.
All right. Thank you for listening. This is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. We hope you have a wonderful weekend watching the Olympics and doing whatever else you do for the week ahead. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, but we are editorially independent. Oh, and by the way, there is
The Trojans are playing.
Yeah. And there is actually a former UALR Trojan competing. Let me get it. Natasha Wodak, 34-year-old from Canada, attended UALR around the year 2000. She's competing in the 10K, so see how she does. Thanks again. I'm Chris Hickey.
Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
A big thanks goes out also to Michael Hiblin and Jonathan Reeves of KASU, who joined us for a segment earlier. Thanks for hosting Morning Edition, Sarah. We look forward to you becoming the All Things Considered anchor after your week of vacation. Have a good one.
Thanks.